All right. Well, apologies to those who are continuing to file in, but I think I'll get us started. And if they miss my introductory remarks, that is not the great tragedy of the century. So good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Federalist Society, welcome. My name is Louis Capozzi. I'm a steering committee member of the Philadelphia Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. I'm a proud graduate of Penn Law. I've completed two clerkships at the United States Courts of Appeals, and I will be starting a final clerkship at the U.S. Supreme Court in just a few weeks. It is my pleasure to serve as the moderator of tonight's event. Before getting started, I'd like to thank our chapter leaders, Matt Hank and Steve Lee, for helping make this event possible. Thank you also to our co-sponsoring chapters, the Pittsburgh Lawyers Chapter, the Harrisburg Lawyers Chapter, the Delaware Lawyers Chapter, and the New Jersey Lawyers Chapter. To everyone from those chapters who is joining us tonight, welcome. I'd also like to acknowledge Lisa Ezell, Jenny Mahoney, and the other great people at the Federalist Society's National Office. Thank you for all that you do. For those unfamiliar with the Federalist Society, we are a group of conservatives and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. If you are interested in getting more involved, don't hesitate to reach out. Let's turn to tonight's topic. The Constitution does not establish the size of the Supreme Court. Congress has that power. Although the size of the court fluctuated during the 19th century, Congress set the number at 9 justices in 1869, and that number has held ever since, even against a major reform attempt by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. After a period of relative quiet, calls to increase the size of the Supreme Court have been growing. President Donald Trump and a GOP-led Senate collaborated to appoint 3 justices to the Supreme Court, Justices Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, along with more than 200 judges to the lower federal courts. These successes have galvanized progressive anxiety, making court packing a major campaign issue during the 2020 presidential election. The drama has continued since the election, with substantial pressure coming from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. President Biden issued an executive order in April creating the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. Among other things, this commission of law professors, judges, and other members of the legal community is charged with considering, quote, the membership and size of the court, end quote. As the commission begins its deliberations, the Supreme Court is assembling a very contentious docket for the upcoming 2021 term, including potential major cases on abortion, the Second Amendment, and the administrative state. So, tonight's debate on court packing and other potential reforms to the Supreme Court is timely, and we have 2 great speakers to get the conversation going. Speaking first is Carrie Severino. She is the president of Judicial Crisis Network, a prominent advocacy group that supported the nominations of Justice Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. She is the co-author of Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Nomination and the Future of the Court, a riveting inside look at the confirmation process. If you watch cable television, you've probably seen her talking about the courts, as she has logged hundreds of television appearances. A graduate of Harvard Law School, she clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas and Judge David Sentell on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Speaking second is Professor Ryan Dorfler. He is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Before that, he was a professor at Penn Law, where I enjoyed taking his statutory interpretation class. His research focuses on the federal courts and the philosophy of language. He is also co-author of a recent article in The Atlantic making arguments in favor of reducing the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. He earned a JD and a PhD from Harvard University and then clerked for Judge Sandra Lynch on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. After our speakers give opening remarks and have some back and forth, I will open the floor to audience questions. You will see on the lower right side of your screen a Q&A box. You can type your questions into there, and then I will pass them along to our two speakers. For those attending to get CLE credit, I will read tonight's code word during the Q&A period. Without further ado, the floor is yours, Carrie. Oh, you are muted.
There we go. Sorry, I have six kids in, a couple of rooms away, so I find it I need to mute about every chance I get. Sorry if I just let me know if I forget to mute again later on. Thanks so much. I really appreciate being able to be here. I appreciate not having to get on a train to come and see you guys, but I do hope that next time I speak at the Philadelphia Chapel, it'll be once again in person and we can actually meet and really chat about these things. I thank you, Lewis, also for that introduction. I think that provides a very good background to tonight's topic. I've heard there are some people on the Democratic side who want to increase the number of judges. I think it was a bad idea when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to pack the court. 9 seems to be a good number, and it's been that way for a long time. In fact, if anything would make the court appear partisan, it would be just that. One side saying that, we're in power, we're going to enlarge the number of judges, so we'll have more people who will vote the way we want them to. So I'm not at all in favor of that solution to what I see as a temporary situation. Those, of course, aren't my words. Those are the words of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was asked about packing the Supreme Court. I could kind of go on all night reading wonderful quotes by people who, on the left side of the aisle and on the bench who have argued that court packing is a bad idea. Ruth Bader Ginsburg obviously alluded to FDR's example. Justice Breyer, memorably earlier this year, said he was concerned that those who want to make what he terms structural changes or other similar institutional changes, such as court packing, should think long and hard before they embody those changes into law. Because, as he said, structural alteration motivated by the perception of political influence only feeds that latter perception, further eroding that trust. Maybe it's not the punchiest way to say it. Justice Breyer is known for his long-winded examples. But the bottom line, as he pointed out, is if you have a political motivation to change the court, that actually only feeds this idea that the court is being dominated not by law, but by politics. And so attempts to change the court, saying, we're going to make it less political, ultimately, if they're being done for a political reason themselves, because they think the court is the wrong kind of political, I guess, has a problem as well. And then no other than Bernie Sanders as well. I'll invoke all of the liberals in my defense on the issue of court packing, pointed out that, as many have, that the idea of court packing would institute a tit for tat, a one-way ratchet where each side would necessarily want to increase judges. He speculated it could get up to 86. It sounds crazy, but honestly, that's exactly what happened in Venezuela over the last few decades, where Hugo Chavez moved the Supreme Court from a already fairly large, in my opinion, 20 members to 32 members. Then his successor, Maduro, added another 13 members onto the Supreme Court, so that you've doubled the Supreme Court in the matter of two decades. And it's no surprise that when he did that, following his 2004 initial packing of the court since then, never once in over 45,000 rulings ever came up with a decision that disagreed with his administration. My biggest concern with court packing isn't the absolute number of justices. There's nothing magic about the number 9. It obviously has been different numbers at different times in history. My concern about all of the changes that are being proposed, the structural changes being proposed to the court nowadays, is that they are being proposed for sometimes nakedly, sometimes more quietly partisan reasons, and that the actual reasoning is clearly to gain partisan advantage on the court. And so that at the bottom is what makes these changes so problematic. I think there are a lot of reforms that we can talk about that might have some merits to them. For example, term limits. You know, there have been proposals for ways to institute term limits. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the idea that when the framers envisioned the judiciary, not only was the average age of lifespan a lot shorter, but people stayed in the court a lot less time. The job was much more physically demanding than it is now because they were riding circuit. The job was less prestigious and it, frankly, less broad. It wasn't as much of a full-time job and encompassing as much of the country's legal livelihoods. And so you didn't have the concern of people staying on decades and decades. That has changed now. So could we talk about some proposals that might, you know, have a cycling through term limit system? Certainly. But what we have seen from the proposals that are coming out now is things coming out in the context of a clear partisan motive, which is, at least as far as I can best explain it, the idea that the nomination and confirmation of Justice Gorsuch to replace Scalia, as opposed to having hearings and vote on Merrick Garland to replace Scalia, is somehow the unforgivable sin that therefore opens the door and says things that otherwise might not have been thinkable, might not have been wise, that maybe even that we acknowledge are still unwise. But you're hearing some people on the left say is somehow thinkable because of this one act of not the fact that President Obama was not able to replace Justice Scalia. I think that's a real that really clarifies what the actual motivation there is, because I think it boils down to frustration with a single maybe not a single seat, because I think a lot of people are continue to be frustrated that Justice Ginsburg's seat was replaced by Justice Barrett. However, these calls for court packing preceded that as well. I think it's the kind of concern that motivates this that really illustrates what the real motivation is. Just to remind people of what the history is of court packing, because I think we've heard some people play fast and loose with the language. I don't think Professor Dorfman's one of them, but I've certainly heard this from politicians speaking about it, including those who are presenting the now proposed legislation to pack the court, which would add 4 justices to bring it up to 13 justices, suggesting that we're not packing the court, we're unpacking the court. Let's talk about what packing the court really means. Packing the court is a term that was used in particular, historically, for Franklin Delano Roosevelt's attempts to increase the number of Supreme Court justices in response to his frustration with the court's unwillingness to find many of his New Deal proposals constitutional. So the court kept on striking down laws that he was proposing as outside the Constitution's bounds. And he proposed a plan that would add seats to the court. He actually at least had a fig leaf of the justices are getting older, so we're going to add an extra seat for everyone who's over the age of 70 because these guys need some extra help. You know, that frankly was not super plausible even at the time, because FDR, as a very popularly elected president whose Democratic Party also held broad majorities in Congress, nonetheless was flatly rejected by the public and by his own co-partisan members in Congress in his attempts, because they could see that this wasn't truly about justices need backup on the court. They recognized it was really about an attempt to change the ideology of the court by changing its personnel. The story that sometimes has gotten told of this is, well, he didn't need to pack the court because he wasn't successful in packing the court legislatively by adding justices. He ultimately was successful because his threats to pack the court caused what's been termed the switch in time to save 9, in which Justice Owen Roberts changed from had a pattern of tending to overturn FDR's legislation to voting in favor of it. And so, okay, he didn't need to worry about putting pressure on the court because Roberts kind of letting off steam of the pressure cooker of the court at that point. That historically has been proven to be inaccurate because it turns out that his vote was cast before the court packing proposal was actually made. So Roberts had been changing, I guess, in time already in advance of this thing. But I think the instinct is still one that is worth reminding ourselves of today, because I one of the other aspects of the court packing phenomenon that really concerns me is the way it has been used as an intimidation tactic against members of the Supreme Court. I think in particular, ironically, yet another Justice Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts in this case, because I think we've seen for many years now, the perception, accurately or not, that Justice Roberts's concerns about the quote, legitimacy of the court are an Achilles heel for him or a pressure point for him that can be used by those advocating for the court, both in the normal means like amicus briefs or in actual arguments for the court, and in sort of non-traditional means, for example, op-eds or presidential speeches. Obama was famously making comments about the legitimacy of the court. As we now know, Chief Justice Roberts was rethinking what his vote should be in the Obamacare case. We also had this pressure campaign from outside the court saying, wow, the court's going to look really illegitimate if they strike down Obamacare, things like that, that people were exerting this outside pressure on the court because they thought threats against its legitimacy would move him. Well, we've now seen threats against the personnel of the court being used the same way. Senator Whitehouse and several of his Democratic colleagues, now a couple of years ago, filed an amicus brief in the previous New York rifle and pistol case. There's another one coming up this coming term, but the previous one, suggesting that if the court did not strike that case down as moot, they would be forced to consider these structural changes to the court, obviously alluding to court packing. And I think many people on both sides of the aisle correctly identified that as a mafiosi-style threatening technique to the court. Unfortunately, it's one that at least, from the outside appears to potentially have been successful. The court did dismiss that case as moot. Whether it's impossible to know, of course, whether it did so purely on legal grounds, because it was not an open and shut case, I think. However, Justice Alito, I believe it was, wrote a opinion in that case that sort of suggested that these threats may have played a role. And that I find very troubling. The idea that that threats against the court, against the institution of the court, are being used as an attempt to manipulate justices. We're seeing the same thing with Justice Breyer's retirement plans, because moments practically, I think a day or two after Breyer made those statements at Harvard Law School that I alluded to, criticizing those who would pack the court as being actually politicizing the court, the left-wing dark money-funded group Demand Justice started running mobile billboards around Washington, D.C. With hashtag Retire Breyer on them and suggesting that Justice Breyer needed to retire. That I don't know if they had those already planned and in the works before, but the timing certainly made it seem like, hey, now that you are not towing the line with us on this key issue, we have no more need for you, and we're going to try to start this pressure campaign that I think, there seems to be a lot of debate on the left as to how appropriate that is. You have some people who are writing op-eds, and there was just yesterday, I think it was in the New York Times, I can't remember, a piece saying Breyer needs to retire right now, and other people saying this is really inappropriate. Let's not, this is arm twisting is not the direction we should go. But there have been people who have explicitly stated, if Breyer doesn't want the court to be packed, the best thing he could do is step down and give Biden a seat to fill right now. That, again, it's inappropriate to be trying to get him to retire in the first place. That makes it doubly inappropriate to be effectively threatening the institution of the court with developments that probably all of us, including both of us on either side of this debate, can agree would be a bad move in terms of packing the court for openly partisan reasons. And using that as a manipulation technique of a justice is particularly inappropriate. And I think it's, from my perspective, one of the things that seems to be driving this move As I alluded to, dark money funding this ban going around. I think we can also see that, unfortunately, potentially playing a role in even President Biden's own openness to the idea. He famously, I'm sure all of you have now seen replay on repeat play, his arguments about court packing being a bonehead idea when FDR did it, how that was an abuse of power or an attempted abuse of power at the time. And suddenly Biden went from that position in 1983 to I don't think it's a good idea, which is what he said in 2020 before he was the presidential nominee. And then $145 million of dark money donations to his campaign later from some of the same network, the Arabella Advisors network that funds some of the same people who are advocating for Supreme Court changes like this. And suddenly he's instituting a commission to maybe we'll look into it. He went to the position of, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to say, but you know, maybe I'm open to it. And now we're seeing that come full circle with the commission having been instituted. At least, they have a list of different reforms they're proposing that we won't hear from the commission until November 10th. But from my perspective, what I see is a nominee shifting his own position to the direction that he's being manipulated by the deepest pockets and the largest donors. And that is also something that I think is a concern, particularly when it's one that I don't think reflects where the country is, but I don't even think reflects where his own party is on this particular issue. So there's a whole lot more I could say, but I want to turn it over to Professor Dorfman, and then we'll have some chance afterwards to go back and forth on these issues as well.
Thank you, Kerry. Professor Dorfler, please take it away.
Sure. Thanks, Lewis. Great to see you again. And thank you, Kerry. Those are great remarks to kick us off. So a lot to say. So I guess what I will note just as the outset, it is remarkable the difference in perception depending on one's political standpoint in terms of Kerry's evaluation of the recently sort of active Supreme Court Commission is much more, I would say, optimistic than my assessment. Kerry describes it as marking a shift, Biden attempting or recognizing a shift in President Biden's position on court packing. I guess I see it as the opposite, as designed basically to produce at best like a modest term limit proposal, certainly nothing more than that. But more generally, so I thought what was really instructive, I think, about Kerry's remarks and also her accurate recounting of Justice Breyer's recent remarks and also President Biden's earlier remarks on the issue of court reform generally and Supreme Court court packing in particular, is I think all of those remarks reflect a particular picture of like what is the court's role, right? And what is it that gives the court the legitimacy that it has or that it aspires to, right? So Kerry said that what disturbed her most was that what seemed to be driving these calls for reform were really partisan motivations or political motivations, right? This wasn't a sort of good governance concern with how the court was operating. Rather, it was like, look, the court's getting the wrong results viewed from a particular political standpoint. And that sort of motivation is inappropriate with respect to the Supreme Court. And again, the reason why is that the underlying picture of what gives the court legitimacy is that it is doing something other than politics, right? So Lewis started off, right, describing the principles of the Federalist Society, again, a commitment to separation of powers, and more specifically relevant here, right, this idea that the role of the court is to say what the law is, not what it should be, right? So again, the sort of distinction between law identification, on the one hand, that's the role of courts, lawmaking. On the other, that's the role of legislatures, right? Role of the political branches. And so I think similarly in Justice Breyer's comments, right, this idea that, look, the court loses legitimacy if the justices are viewed as junior politicians, and this idea that, look, adding justices for partisan reasons, that just adds to that perceived illegitimacy, right? This idea that no, the court isn't doing law, it's doing mere politics, and that is a problem. Now, I think this is a familiar picture of the court, right? It goes back to just Chief Justice Roberts's remarks about, you know, this ideal of the justices as umpires, calling balls and strikes, things like that. But I think this is actually a pretty pervasive sort of picture of what it is that makes the court legitimate. I think, though, what is difficult about that ideal and what really motivates me or orients my thinking with respect to this issue of court reform is even if you're sympathetic to that ideal, which I have to say, as somebody on the political left, I actually find that ideal more attractive than most on sort of given people with my political valence. So in my earlier scholarly work, I've written sort of from a sort of broadly textualist standpoint, like I actually find sort of interpretive formalism an attractive approach to judging and to statutory and even constitutional interpretation. But at the same time, I do think that if that is the ideal of judging that one wants to advance, the question is, under what conditions is adherence to that ideal possible? Right, because I think Lewis described the sort of court queuing up its docket for the next year, right? And what do we have on tap, right? We have questions about what's the scope of abortion rights in the United States, right? Gun rights under the Second Amendment, right? Also, like, what is the permissible scope of the administrative state, right? What sort of delegations of authority to agencies are Congress permitted, is Congress permitted to make, right? And these are some of the most pressing policy issues in our state today, right? These are the sort of exactly the sort of hotly contested political issues that sort of are real sort of flashpoints in our society, right? And yet, right, as Lewis observes, right, this institution that is designed, at least allegedly, to settle strictly legal questions, right, not doing politics. We're just calling it straight, identifying what the law is, right? This institution finds itself in a position of needing to answer these sort of hotly contested political questions. And so, given that task, right, given that those questions are the questions that the court is being asked to answer, or at least takes it upon itself to answer, I guess my concern and my concern with my co-author, Samuel Moyne, with whom I write on these issues, is that, look, insofar as the court is asked to answer these sorts of questions, it's just not possible for the court to comply with that ideal of doing law rather than politics. The court is specifically asked, or at least specifically has taken upon itself, to answer political questions. And so at that point, right, if you are a politician, if you are, you know, a progressive member of Congress, you're President Biden, right, you'd be foolish to treat the court as something other as an apolitical institution, right, to refuse to add justices to the court who see things the way that you see the world, right, because like it would be insane not to do that insofar as the court is just rendering judgment on these critical political questions, right? It would just be sort of bafflingly naive not to do so, right? And so for that reason, I think people, this perception, look, the court is doing politics. The court is answering these hotly contested political issues. Right. This, I think, is exactly what drives the motivation for the call for court packing from the left. And again, I have sympathy towards that response. Now, I, you know, at the same time, like I agree, as Kerry said, quoting President Senator Sanders, right, this concern that, look, adding justices to the court will set up a spiral. Right. And then, you know, we'll find ourselves being, you know, Venezuela or Poland or whatever. I'm sympathetic to that critique, which is why then, in terms of the reforms that that Sam and I have advocated, our approach has been instead to say, okay, well, maybe there's a way of changing what it is that the court does, right? Maybe we can actually take some of these political questions away from the court, thus allowing it to at least adhere more closely to that ideal that Lewis started with, that Kerry was articulating, that Justice Breyer is articulating, et cetera. Right. And so our sort of reform proposals, I mean, again, we set out a menu of possibilities, but the basic idea is, rather than sort of changing who it is or what is the political orientation of the individuals that exercise this tremendous power that the Supreme Court currently enjoys, right? Our approach is to take that power away from the court and redirect those sorts of squarely political decisions, right? Those hotly contested political or policy questions or decisions to the political branches, right? In particular, to redirect them to Congress, right? And so there are various sort of mechanisms that one can deploy to do so, right? We talk, for example, about jurisdiction stripping, right? Congress, through ordinary legislation, taking various types of questions away from the court, just sort of removing, withdrawing from the court jurisdiction over, let's say, gun legislation or abortion legislation or administrative delegation questions, things like that. Similarly, we've suggested a supermajority rule for this court to invalidate or to declare invalid federal legislation, right? So under the current regime, the Supreme Court can, by a simple majority, 5-4 vote, declare an act of Congress constitutionally invalid. We propose Congress, again, through ordinary legislation, imposing a requirement of, let's say, a 6-3 or 7-2 majority in order for Congress for the court to declare an act of Congress unconstitutional. There are other mechanisms that one can talk about. I think more important, though, is, again, what is the goal of judicial reform? And again, Sam and I think that the real goal ultimately ought to be not, again, to sort of get the court to answer political questions correctly, so much as just to take those, again, to take those questions away from the court and redirect them to the Democratic arena, which, again, sort of setting aside whatever you think the sort of better, whatever you think the policy outcomes will be under those various regimes, again, as Lewis started out with, that picture is actually in a way is perfectly consistent with the federal society picture, which is to say, again, judges shouldn't be answering political questions. Judges should be identifying law. We want Congress or other political branch actors to do that sort of work. And so that's the basic picture that we articulate. And now, having said that, right, when we wrote that initial Atlantic piece, right, the contrast that we drew was between court packing on the one hand and all what we call disempowering reforms on the other, right? Saying, look, court packing, not attractive. All you're doing is sort of continuing to treat this or continuing to permit this institution, this Supreme Court, to act as this incredibly important political institution. Again, you're going to set off spirals. What we need to do instead is to draw authority away from it. Since then, though, I have to say, I have grown much more sympathetic to treating court packing and disempowering reforms as a package deal. And the reason is simply that I'm incredibly skeptical that the current Supreme Court would look favorably upon a package of disempowering reforms by themselves. So I am worried that the current justices would look skeptically upon aggressive jurisdiction stripping legislation or a supermajority requirement. And so for that reason, I do think it would be entirely sensible for, I think at this point, it would be Democrats who would do this, but I think for reformers generally, if your goal was to effectively disempower the Supreme Court, I do think adding sympathetic justices to who would affirm that the legislation affecting that change, I think that would be a perfectly appropriate and sensible approach. And I'm happy to say more about that. One other thing, though, I did want to mention, though, I think Carrie, I mean, ironically, she also described calls for court packing as a sort of intimidation tactic, right? Trying to pressure the justices to get the right answers on certain cases. And I think what's interesting is, I think actually, again, purely from a strong separation of powers, say what the law is, not what the law should be, standpoint, I actually think that's the most sympathetic case for court packing, even as a standalone reform, right? So again, at least if you, I mean, as Carrie referenced, the sort of historical story surrounding FDR's court packing strategy is contested, but we do have a sort of rough historical coincidence with a sort of rising concern with the Supreme Court, in particular, the court's interventionism, and calls for reform generally, followed by a dramatic shift in the court's appetite for declaring federal legislation invalid, right? And so, and Sam and I have written about this in a recentish New Republic piece, the sort of happy narrative about there is to say, look, actually threats of court packing in particular, or at least judicial reform in general, maybe did for at least a brief historical period, actually caused the court to self-regulate, right? Actually caused the court to adopt what we think of as more like a Thayerian stance, right? The sort of James Bradley Thayer, the idea that courts should only declare federal legislation invalid in cases of quote unquote clear unconstitutionality, right? So cases of clear legal violation. By contrast, if the constitutionality is questionable, not clearly identifiable law, courts should stay their hand. Right, this sort of modest, non-interventionist approach to judging. There's a historical narrative that says that, look, actually the threat of court packing induced the court to stay its own hand, to self-regulate. And for some proponents of court packing, I think they actually think that's exactly what we're trying to do. The end goal is not actually to pack the Supreme Court. It's merely to pressure the justices into not declaring the modern administrative state unconstitutional, for example. That's the real goal, just to get the justices to sort of back off. Now, as Sam and I argue in that piece, I don't think that's actually ultimately a persuasive case for court packing as a standalone reform. The reason that, as we saw in that earlier historical period, and as one would predict today, that period of self-regulation, of internal constraint on the part of the justices, was incredibly short-lived, right? So, and as soon as the sort of specter of court packing or other judicial reform faded, we saw the justices in relatively short order, right? Less than really sort of not much more than a decade, return to really active interventionism. And so that, I think, is exactly what one would predict again. And so for that reason, again, Sam and I think it's very important to formally sort of pull power away from the justices by imposing external constraints on the exercise of authority by the court, rather than relying on the sort of internal constraint, right? Trying to pressure or persuade the justices to act as Thayerians. We think that that is sort of unlikely to succeed, at least in the long term. Maybe it would succeed in the short term, but not much beyond that. But more generally, I want to say, like, I do think insofar as one's ideal is this of the justices as doing something other than politics, right? The justices as doing law. If that's one's ideal, you can't just sort of take it for granted that that is what the court is doing, right? And importantly, the criticism here is not that, look, the judges are being bad actors by engaging in politics. Rather, the observation is the questions that the court is currently asked to answer really don't admit of identifiable legal answers, right? The Constitution is a pretty vague document. And certainly on issues like non-delegation or abortion rights, things like that, right? There's not a lot of precise constitutional text that you can meaningfully interpolate. And so again, insofar as the court has continued to asked to answer those sorts of questions, it can't help but do politics, right? That's all there is for the court to do in those difficult cases that it's currently presented with. And so insofar as that is one's ideal, right, I think one should actually be sympathetic to exactly the sort of disempowering agenda that Sam and I have articulated. Okay, so I'll stop there because I'm looking forward to engaging in more conversation, less monologue.
And Kerry, I'll give you a chance to respond. A quick reminder to the audience, a couple of questions have come in. If you want to ask a question, please click on that Q&A box on the bottom of your screen, type your question in, and I will pass that along to our panelists once they've had a little back and forth. But Kerry, I'll give you the chance to respond.
Yeah, this is a great discussion. I think I've got a lot of interesting points brought up by Professor Dorfman. Maybe going, I guess I'm starting backwards here. First of all, just it's interesting to see the embrace, I guess, of the intimidation goal of court packing. But I want to take issue with the idea of terming it self-regulation of the court. To me, as a parent that has gone through a lot of toddlers at this point, if the toddler hands the toy to his little brother because you're standing over them, I don't then say, oh, wow, I'm so glad my five-year-old is self-regulating, because I knew as soon as I walk out of the room, he's going to hit him on the head and grab it back again. So I don't think that really is self-regulation, that's just, intimidation of having someone looking over your shoulder. And I'll point out that the idea of the way that the court was set up was by our founders was explicitly to try to limit that intimidation process as much as possible. They had two parts to it, right? The nomination and confirmation of justices is in fact inherently political. And I think that is where the check on the courts from the political branches is designed constitutionally to come from. So I'm not saying there's no political aspect to it at all, because obviously that is a political input going in. But then the idea is that the justices are not supposed to have that political influence once they're on the court, which is why they're given life tenure. So, practically speaking, I'm sure that does happen. There are instances of these sort of intimidation things going back and forth, but I think that is contrary to our constitutional design. Going to the idea of the growing openness to court packing, because as you said, the courts are not necessarily going to be open to your idea of jurisdiction stripping or other proposals you meant. That concerns me, because I think what you're alluding to is the fact that actually there are constitutional questions as to whether jurisdiction stripping and some of the proposals you've made could be done short of constitutional amendment. Now, that doesn't say they're not good ideas or couldn't be feasible if you actually amended the Constitution. But I think the fact of the matter is, they are constitutionally controversial. And so what I see you've done is just said, hey, well, now I've got some other proposals that are kind of neutral, but now I'm going to insulate them further by allowing for the court packing. So ultimately, it's just saying, I need a mechanism to make sure that my preferred policy outcome, whether it's the direct policy outcome on everything from guns to abortion to the environment to whatever, gets insulated from court removing it, or whether it's my second degree procedural structural things that have to get insulated so that I can get, or you know, whatever the motivation of those is. I think that that strikes me as a real concern, because it's still motivated solely by, I want my, this policy is so important to me that I'm willing to undermine what I otherwise would have thought was a good idea for the court to insulate it. Third point, I've got just four comments I had, and then you can obviously come back on it. I think we actually, I really like your approach to limiting the courts, the jurisdiction stripping as a broader goal, but I think I would approach it in a different way. I agree. I think part of the problem is that courts are doing politics instead of doing law. I don't think that the fact that they're making their questions about things that are in the political sphere and are hotly contested means they're doing politics, though. So on the one end, you know, there are some really politically hot questions that were decided at the Constitutional Convention. Those weren't like non-third rail issues, you know, the how to balance the government and the power of different types of states and slavery. And I mean, huge issues, right? Those were decided, though, by the Constitution. And so a court interpreting them then isn't the court necessarily doing politics, even though the question they're holding on, they're opining on is and ultimately was a political question. Some of these feel less political because they're so settled now, but they're certainly be open for debate if you were starting over with a new constitution, right? It's because they're actually interpreting a text. And so this goes to my question about how would you do jurisdiction stripping? I would say the way that jurisdiction stripping actually properly happens under the Constitution is by having a very limited role of the idea of judges being limited to what's textually in the Constitution and the original meaning thereof. So for example, I agree, the Supreme Court, getting the Supreme Court into the nitty gritty of how abortion regulation should be done is not a great idea. This is a third rail issue that is not a great idea, not just because it causes a huge amount of problems because people are, you know, having judges deciding these issues, but chiefly because it's actually not in the Constitution. So one major thing, I'd be happy to strip away all jurisdiction from the Supreme Court that is not in fact in the Constitution. So if they're not opining on something that is a constitutional provision, then we can take that off the table. That doesn't mean courts and governments don't get to deal with it. The federal government could pass laws respecting abortion. States can pass laws respecting abortion. They can have their own constitutional discussions about whether they want to include it in Constitution. But if it's not in our Constitution, it's not the job of justices to find ways to bring things that they think are so overwhelmingly important they should have been in the Constitution into it. Similarly, I found it amusing that you said, well, the court could strip jurisdiction from dealing with gun regulation from it. Some might argue that that's a little bit what it did in the Second Amendment. The court actually said that it shouldn't, these rights had to be protected. So, and even clearer, you know, if you want to talk about what kind of language one might use for jurisdiction stripping, the First Amendment almost sounds like it. Congress shall make no law. You know, that actually is what I would say our Constitution is designed to do, is take certain areas out of the purview of not even just the courts, but the government, the federal government, and altogether in certain instances, right? So, anyway, I think there are ways that some of these issues could be taken off the table if we had a more originalist approach to the law. And I think also just the fact that it's political doesn't necessarily mean it's not. There's not an actual legal answer. It might not be a legal answer that everyone in the country agrees on, but it still could be a legal answer. And then the approach to addressing the contested nature of the controversial nature of it would be to see if there's political will to pass a law to change it, not to get frustrated if the court is actually interpreting a law that has become controversial. So back to you for any further follow-up.
Sure. Thanks, Gary. So first I want to say, I actually really like your metaphor in terms of the sort of as soon as you're not in the room, the children will not self-regulate. I think it's exactly right. But again, I think this is why I think that jurisdiction or that the sort of threat of court packing, it will be a sort of short short term efficacy in terms of causing moderation, which is why I think that, again, we need more interventionists. We need to you need to reach in yourself and hold the toy away, and that would be Congress acting in your stead. I think what's interesting is, so you say like, well, maybe we can strip the court of jurisdiction over things that like aren't in the Constitution, quote unquote. And now, I mean, so I want to accept first, I think you're exactly right to say that mere political contestation is not enough to show that there's no legal answer, right? So for example, equal apportionment of the Senate, I think is currently rightly being contested as a political matter, right? Is this normatively or democratically defensible, right? West Virginia or New Hampshire have equal representation in the Senate to states like California or New York. Unfortunately, I would agree that there is, in fact, a relatively clear legal answer. Although I do think there are sort of clever ideas out there about maybe try ways to circumvent that are consistent with the Constitution. But at least absent sort of pretty aggressive congressional action, we're stuck with equal apportionment in the Senate. On the other hand, though, right, when it comes to, again, the scope of the administrative state, authority for Congress to regulate guns, abortion regulation, things like that, I think those areas are much more contested. And in fact, the question of whether those issues are, quote unquote, in the Constitution is precisely the thing that's in dispute. And so so in those areas, in those what you call constitutionally contested areas, right? You said rightly, I think that the sorts of reforms that Sam and I are proposing, or even court packing, or even, like all kinds of judicial reforms on the table, I think all of those are constitutionally controversial. But my point is to suggest that issues that are, quote unquote, constitutionally controversial are precisely those sorts of questions that don't admit of a, quote unquote, clear and constitutional answer. Right. And so for that reason are exactly the sorts of questions that courts should be sort of leaving alone. And I thought it was interesting because you mentioned also, you say, like, look, the design of the Constitution, right, is meant to insulate judges from political pressure. I think that's right. Obviously, life tenure and salary protection serve that function. But I think it's also telling that, at least with respect to judicial review, the early understanding of the court's authority was simultaneously exactly the sort of picture that I'm articulating. This idea of only that courts should only declare federal legislation invalid in case this is a clear constitutional violation, right? So the court was dramatically less interventionist with respect to its exercise of judicial review early in its tenure, right? And so in a way, what the reforms of the sort that Sam and I are proposing is effectively to sort of force the court to go back to that original understanding of the judicial role, right? Again, sort of to make it make sense that justices enjoy life tenure, insofar as there are purely legal questions out there, at least closer, that we can limit the court's workload to something much closer to the idea of sort of doing pure law as opposed to doing politics. Okay, so I'm happy to stop there because I want to get to questions from the audience.
And I would love to ask some questions. Of course, we can keep the conversation going and the great back and forth. For the audience members that are obtaining CLE credit for tonight's event, the code word to show that you attended is 9-9. Topical, easy to remember, 9. So the first question from the audience, a bit sharply worded, it's directed to Professor Dorfler. He asks, is the problem with your position that it's bad for conservatives? The questioner asks if your thesis is, we've had our fill and the dessert doesn't appeal to us, so let us end the dinner early. He says that conservatives have developed and deployed the skill of burying a liberal Supreme Court for decades and decades. Why should a change come now as opposed to some later date?
Good. One is I would hotly aggressively contest the thesis that conservatives have been dealing with a liberal Supreme Court for decades. In decades. Within my lifetime, there's not been a liberal majority on the Supreme Court. I'm not that old, but I'm at least in middle age at this point. So it's been quite some time. And in in fact, it is a bit sort of frustrating when I argue with sort of, you know, liberal or left-leaning constitutional law professors who are much more protective of the role of the Supreme Court than I am, right? They're constantly left to appeal to the Warren Court era, right? That was the last good era from their perspective. So I don't think this is a sort of like Johnny come lately, like, hey, you know, things were really great for us up until Neil Gorsuch was appointed to the Supreme Court. I think that's just blatantly false. I've also been entirely consistent, as has been Sam, in my sort of anti-court or sort of, again, disempowering sort of attitude towards the court. So this is, I at least sort of have paid my dues in terms of limited judicial power. And so I just don't think that's right. Now, I mean, there is a sort of question you could ask, like, well, could we do sort of some sort of like time delayed, you know, implementation, you know, okay, so we'll start doing we'll enact a bunch of jurisdiction stripping legislation, but it will go into effect in 5 years or 10 years, something like that. If I thought that there was any chance that doing that would bring on board 10 Republican senators to pass this through the filibuster in the Senate, I might be open to that sort of proposal. I have absolutely no optimism that adding that sort of time delay would make anyone receptive to that. And so for that reason, I don't think it's very attractive. I think especially given the current political stakes for Democrats right now, I think it would just be foolish, given that any sort of judicial reform is going to have to be enacted by Democrats alone, it would be foolish for them to allow the existing Supreme Court to invalidate climate legislation or a wealth tax or something like that. But again, like if Republicans showed up tomorrow saying like, yeah, we'll strip the court of massive authority if you wait 10 years, you know, I'd be happy to talk.
So I'm a little perplexed because it sounds like you're saying that, yeah, that there actually isn't a neutral goal of these are good changes neutrally. It's really just how would these changes reflect on, say, the goal of not having climate change regulations overturned? This is what I mean with respect to like life tenure. People have been batting around for years the idea of how could we change this. If it's really a true structural issue on the court, then maybe it's worth doing in a bipartisan way. This is part of the reason that some of these changes, I think, the reason they're constitutionally questionable is because it seems that the Constitution has, for example, in the case of jurisdiction stripping, you know, they gave the judicial power to the Supreme Court and the inferior courts, and then the judicial power is defined very broadly to include everything that comes up under the Constitution and laws of the United States. So it's hard to see how you can remove something. You certainly would be hard to see how to remove it entirely from the judicial power. Maybe remove it from one court versus another is another question. But so the bottom line is the Constitution has already set it out. To change that, you would have to, by necessity, have a broad bipartisan coalition because you would need the overwhelming number of states, obviously, to approve something to get a constitutional amendment. Same thing for term limits. So if we're going to, the benefit of that is, that means if we're going to do it, we're going to have to do it in a way that is neutral as to which party it benefits, which ideological faction feels like it's going to win. Everyone's rolling the dice if you say we start this in 20 years or something. I think that's an asset because I don't think we should be doing any messing with the court for political reasons, for any, for these short term, from my perspective, or any real political ends. I'll just add, I find it amusing that you don't think we've had a liberal Supreme Court in your lifetime, but if we haven't had a liberal Supreme Court in lifetime, we haven't had a conservative Supreme Court in my parents' lifetime. Because I'm trying to think of when someone could say, oh, the good old days of the, what, pre-New Deal Supreme Court? I mean, I really can't, at least you have the Warren Court to look back to. So, you know, you can satisfy yourself with that. From my perspective, however, I would say the liberal dominance in the Supreme Court has certainly been very solid over the last few years. Yes, there have been some swing justices, but for most major issues, I don't think there's been a lot of contestation. And that includes, frankly, even if you just took only Republican nominees, you'd still have a very close to swing court, if not liberal court. But obviously perspectives can differ on that.
Yeah, I mean, one is, I think it might be fair to say that we've had a libertarian court for the past several decades. So if you're a social conservative, then you might say that we haven't.
I don't know if libertarians would agree with you, but maybe everyone feels like they're losing.
Well, I think laissez-faire economic libertarians are feeling pretty good. In terms of a neutral basis, no, I completely disagree. There is a neutral basis for this. It's democracy. It's exactly the picture of judging that Lewis started us off with. this idea that judges should not be doing politics. They should be identifying law, not making it. And so my claim is simply that these sorts of issues should be settled in the Democratic arena. That's one that that Justice Scalia, right? This is one that that used to be a sort of standard conservative line. Jurisdiction stripping was sort of a familiar Republican proposal in the 80s, late 70s and into the 80s. And so when it comes to climate legislation, my argument there is simply that, look, Democrats have most recently won Democratic victories, small d Democratic victories. And so they shouldn't forego the benefits of those small d Democratic victories without sort of any sort of instrumental reason to do so. But again, the neutral rationale for the proposals that we advocate is simply small d democracy. These sorts of policy questions should be directed to the small d Democratic arena. And so we're just saying that, look, again, absent reason, Democrats should enjoy the small d Democratic victories that they have managed to secure recently.
Let me just jump in with another audience question that I think is on point. Historically, there have been proposals from both sides of the aisle on jurisdiction stripping, including on abortion cases. And one of the audience members asks about jurisdiction stripping for all cases involving abortion, so denying the federal courts the ability to hear that. So let me ask for your thoughts on that. And also to Carrie, is there a form of jurisdiction stripping that you could get behind, or do you think we should just stay away from this?
So, I think as far as I can go with the level I've had a chance to dig into jurisdiction stripping right now is it is constitutionally not obvious that it's okay. And I understand there's something that conservatives employed as well as liberals. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily constitutional just because it's been done by both parties in recent years. So I think I guess I would sort of beg off of that on the specific thing, because I think I need to look into it. My initial read is just simply like, well, you know what? I get why it's a question, because I can just looking, you know, at the mere text of the words, you can see we're taking something entirely out of the purview of the courts is a challenge. Now, certainly if you took abortion questions out of the courts, that probably would end up in terms of policy wise, creating, you know, opening the door to a lot more state regulation of abortion, et cetera. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing in terms of the legal result. And that's something I haven't had a chance to study yet. I just want to throw in one more quick follow-up though to the ability to enjoy democratic victories. I do think one of the ways that the Constitution sets up that the democratic process, the consequence of the democratic process, although it is one that has a longer time frame on it, is that the president, with the advice and consent of the Senate, gets to nominate and appoint judges. And so it's the way that it is designed. You have that democratic, you enjoy your democratic victory. To the extent that we think judges are doing politics, they're supposed to, it's time to put everyone's pajamas on. That's my alarm. Anyway, it's there is that process. So you could also argue, hey, you're depriving the Republicans of the enjoyment of their democratic victories, democratically won victories, by trying to undermine the judges they've put on the courts. But anyway, so now I've combined two answers into one.
It goes. Just quick. I mean, this is too detailed for Zoom, but in terms of constitutionality of jurisdiction stripping, right? I mean, so Carrie, you rightly said that you know, Article 3 creates a sort of baseline of sweeping jurisdiction. At the same time, Congress is granted authority to grant such exceptions to the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction as it sees fit. Congress also, as you know, is under no obligation whatsoever to even create federal appellate courts or lower federal courts. And so from that, the standard interpretation is that Congress has really near total discretion in terms of lower federal court jurisdiction. And then for state courts, we can go to the Supremacy Clause. But again, that's too detailed for this. In terms of jurisdiction stripping as to abortion in particular, the safe answer is to say, and I think there's something to this, which is to say that the small d to federal legislation, right? The sort of the small d democratic mandate of congressionally enacted law is the most robust as compared to, for example, individual state laws, right? So you could make a supremacy clause sort of base case for distinguishing between federal law and state law. And most abortion cases obviously involve state law, not federal law. So that's the sort of cheap out for me to say, like, well, I'm only talking about federal statutes. We'll get to state statutes later. That's different. It's complicated. Having said that, like, I am completely sympathetic to the idea that, look, like, maybe we should be withdrawing jurisdiction over abortion cases generally. And in particular, the reason why is because I think it's entirely appropriate for Congress to take this issue out of the federal courts, right, currently, right? So in a way, like, it's tremendously frustrating for me as a large D Democrat, right? So President Biden, for example, has said, look, if the current Supreme Court declares Roe unconstitutional, or, you know, declares Roe no longer good law, well, then, you know, Congress is going to come back and legislate Roe. You know, just through federal legislation. And my question is, well, why are we waiting? Right. I mean, so invalidating Roe just says that states may do such and such, that there's no constitutional guarantee to abortion. So why aren't Democrats just sort of preempting that sort of decision by enacting federal legislation that creating a federal right to abortion? Now, our response is to say that, well, you know, in turn, the same Supreme Court that's going to declare Roe no longer good law is also going to declare that statute unconstitutional. I think that's plausible. I think there are strategies to try to draft a federal abortion right that would make it more difficult for the courts to do that. But of course, a sufficiently motivated court could, which again sort of lends support to this idea that statute would also want to be insulated from judicial review through jurisdiction stripping measure.
So I'm going to give you guys both a chance to give a sort of last word, and also just to answer one more question in the process. Where does this all end up? What is your prediction about what Biden's commission will do and what the result of that will be? So last word, and also your prediction about where this is all going.
I guess I'll go first, then go get Professor Dorff for the absolute last word. I think my prediction of, I guess my last word is, even just following up on the jurisdiction stripping thing, this discussion is illustrating there's some of the same problems with that there are with the court packing, the tit for tat kind of thing. I'm just imagining, as we're talking about more and more areas you strip jurisdiction from, you get to the point where, like, the Supreme Court does nothing but your original jurisdiction cases, and it becomes just riparian rights between various states all day, every day, and ambassadors getting in parking tickets or something. I mean, it's hard to, you know, just in terms of is this an universalizable principle we could apply, that it becomes a real problem when we're just saying we're taking everything out of the line of it just as a practical matter. That doesn't bear on its, you know, whether it's legally correct or not, but I do think it makes it practically something we should worry about going down that route, because it just is going to turn into everyone insulates their own favorite things. In terms of where this is all going, you know, I think we may maybe both agree that the Supreme Court Commission is kind of a silly enterprise, maybe for different reasons, maybe on one side because we don't think it's going to accomplish enough. On the other side, I think really what it's there for is, this is a commission of three dozen members, you know, with a handful of conservatives on it. Well, I think on these issues, probably I would say a handful of Republicans on it, who are at least moderate on these particular issues, even if they're conservative on others. It's clearly not designed to achieve any real in-depth inquiry that's going to guide anyone. I think we all could probably agree that President Biden's going to do what he wants to do. I actually think the court packing commission is probably also going to do whatever the winds of political change is going to do. Because I think what Biden will do is not really going to be dictated so much by his own personal, deep, long-held beliefs, because we know those have already shifted with the political winds. I think what he's going to do is whatever is politically feasible for him at that time. And that's going to be a balancing the cross currents of the major pressure he's receiving from the most extreme groups in the left. And as I said, the deep pockets in the left are exerting an incredible amount of pressure. Simultaneously, I think he's going to have the pressure of really the American people, I would say, on the other side, and what is politically feasible for him to do. He clearly didn't think it was politically feasible for him to embrace court packing during the election. And I think there's a good reason for that, because every time you look at studies of it, it's widely unpopular. I view my goal, since I think it's a horrible idea for the court and for the country, as making sure that our elected representatives realize how widely unpopular it is, and realize that it would be just as much political suicide today as it would have been for FDR to try to attempt it. And this is why it wasn't successful then. I think as long as the American people are clear on that, and our elected representatives are clear on that, all the way up to President Biden, that is not the direction they're going to go. I think, however, that the outcome of what the commission states, which my cynical view is they're going to just say whatever it is that the administration would like to do, and then it provides a fig leaf for the administration to do what it is that is most the farthest left. It's kind of like William F. Buckley's rule, but on its head. Instead of vote for the most conservative person who can win, it's like vote for the most, achieve the most liberal result possible that is still politically possible. I think that's what they're going to go for. And whatever that is, I predict the commission is going to recommend that, and then it will provide a fig leaf for President Biden to go in whatever direction that happens to be as the political winds are blowing when the commission's report comes out. I suspect that's going to not be full court packing, which I think is a very good thing, assuming again the way that the American people is looking at this remains constant. It's not going to be popular enough to be able to be gotten through, and Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and maybe even others are holding the line on that. I do think they're going to try, if there are other results that they think would be politically beneficial to them, I think they'll try to achieve those, whether that means jurisdiction stripping or packing, for lack of a better word, the lower courts, adding a bunch of courts to it, to the, the district courts or appellate courts. I don't know what their next best line is, but I think they'll try to figure out what is the most politically beneficial thing we can achieve at this time, and then try to move to that. Maybe compared to court packing, it will look, even extreme proposals might look moderate in comparison. And so they're going to try to ride those wins to success. But I still think, at the end of the day, proposals that are only made to achieve political goals of a single party, that's the wrong reason to institute structural change on our Supreme Court or on the federal courts more broadly.
Thanks again, Lewis, for having me. And thank you, Carrie. It's been a lot of fun. It's great that you brought up the spiraling concern, because I think it's right. I would describe it as a virtuous spiral rather than a vicious one. Sam and I actually talked about this in the law review version of this piece. When we compare jurisdiction stripping with court packing, we say, well, with court packing, you're likely to see a sort of spiraling effect, which we at least first pass find troubling. By contrast, right, with jurisdiction stripping, insofar as you get spiraling, I think we just think like, hey, that's great. Right, more and more stuff getting redirected to the Democratic arena, right? And so in a way, like if at the end of the day all the Supreme Court is hearing are original jurisdiction cases, like I think that'd be great. personally, probably won't get quite that far, but again, I view that spiral as a feature, not a bug. In terms of the commission, it's funny. I think the way I would describe it is actually on the Buckley line. I would say they're going to do the most conservative thing that they can get away with. The reason that President Biden has shown himself to be a small C conservative with respect to institutions, I think that's just true. I mean, whatever the substantive policy views, I agree with Kerry that his substantive policy views have shifted based on the political winds, right? Much more, the relief bill was much more expansive than I would have predicted, on election day. But with respect to institutions, I think we've seen very little enthusiasm, right? Very little pressure from the president to reform the filibuster. And similarly, no indications really whatsoever in terms of enthusiasm to reform the judiciary. So my suspicion is that the proposals will be very modest. And the irony, of course, is that I think term limits are like the most politically palatable reform, but they're also the most constitutionally sort of questionable. they're probably the most difficult square with constitutional text. And so I'm not quite sure how that report's going to read. And so I think what that means then is that this is a longer term fight, right? Because like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, my inbox was full of like requests for like interviews, talks, things like this. And then when on election day, when we saw like this narrow Senate majority, right, those sort of the prospect of short-term reform dropped off dramatically. And exactly, as Carrie mentioned, like people like Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema have shown no enthusiasm whatsoever for filibuster reform generally, let alone major institutional reform like court reform. And so for that reason, I think this is going to be a fight that we're going to continue to have over the next several election cycles, because I don't think any of the political pressures that give rise to the calls for reform are going away. Right. Again, Lewis described the Supreme Court's upcoming docket. Right. There's going to be continuous calls for reform, but this is going to have to play out over a longer time horizon than I think people thought the day that Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. So I think, you know, so stay tuned. So it's going to be a continuing discussion.
Well, thank you both. One of the things we lose when we do Zoom events is we lose the chance for the audience to clap and to make its appreciation known. But I know everyone attending was grateful to have you both. This was a great discussion, a spirited discussion. To our members and to all of our participants, thank you for tuning in tonight. I expect that our next event will be an in-person event and that you will be seeing in-person events soon. And I and all my colleagues on the Philadelphia Lawyers Chapter, we look forward to seeing you in person. So once again, thank you for tuning in, and I hope everyone has a wonderful night.